The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, marine photographer Brian Scarry has traveled the globe, capturing dramatic and moving images of the ocean and the life it supports. We'll speak about his latest work documenting change in the Gulf of Maine. And we'll have a conversation with author and cut paper illustrator Laura Holmesy. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Marine photographer Brian Scarry has traveled the globe, capturing dramatic and moving images of the ocean and the life it supports. For more than four decades, Scarry has been shooting in the Gulf of Maine. The Gulf, which stretches from Cape Cod to Nova Scotia, supports thousands of species. But the Gulf is also changing. It's warming fast. Scarry's work is featured in two new projects, a June cover story in National Geographic magazine, and a three-part PBS Nova series called Sea Change, The Gulf of Maine. I spoke with Scarry to learn more.
I began diving in, I think it was 1977. I actually got certified as a scuba diver in 1978. And my very early dives were in the Gulf of Maine. I grew up in a little town in Massachusetts, and my early dives were in these temperate waters. So I guess for my entire life, I've been partial to temperate zones, to temperate waters. They are also some of the most rich waters in the world. The reason the visibility in places like the Gulf of Maine is not very good is because of all the nutrients that are there. And I guess also partially as a photographer and visual storyteller working in the ocean, these are places that somewhat fewer people work. You know, it's a little bit easier to work in tropical locations where the visibility is really great. So there's an endless source of stories in these places, and that's what's always interested me.
That's almost something that I wouldn't have thought of. Is we think of marine photography, and you get the images in your head of tropical fish, but the Maine waters are green and murky and dramatic. And I'm imagining that as a photographer and a visual storyteller, that that does a lot of the work for you, almost in a way of in a photographer. There's a lot of energy and dramatic presence in the North Atlantic.
There sure is. And, you know, the reason why these waters, places like the Gulf of Maine, have giant whales and these charismatic megafauna are largely because of the food that is here. You know, the humpback whales, for example, they spend the summers, the ones that live in this part of the world, spend the summers up in New England in these waters because there's historically been a lot of food here. They go to the places like the Silver Banks in the Dominican Republic in the wintertime to mate and to have their calves, but they're not feeding a lot when they're down there. This is the place they come and they bulk up. So there's a lot of grist for the mill. It's challenging place to work. You know, visibility is poor. The weather is very unpredictable. You know, going offshore is really dicey sometimes, trying to get, you know, like some of the places we visited for Sea Change, 90 miles out, Cash's Ledge, very hard places to get to. But if you persevere and if you're, you know, dedicated to this, you can tell some amazing stories.
So in your latest project, Sea Change, what did you originally set out to capture? And because the Gulf of Maine is changing, did your approach have to change during the photography process, or did your focus of the story that you wanted to tell change on the ocean's terms?
Well, it's a great question, Lucas. And, you know, my answer would be better if I could give a little context. So I mentioned that, you know, I started diving here 47 years ago. And, you know, the last 26 years, I've worked as a National Geographic magazine photographer, creating stories about the ocean. I propose ideas. If they like it, I go and do them. Now moving more into documentary film and so forth, or doing both. And ever since I began working as a professional, visual storyteller, if you will, I've always wanted to do a story on the Gulf of Maine, on New England waters, because of the reasons I described earlier. It's near and dear to my heart. But, my work took me to every other continent. I've, done over 30 stories for Geographic and films now. But always in the back of my mind, my editors will tell you, I was always discussing this idea of doing a story on this region. It became urgent when I read this scientific paper that was published a few years ago that said the Gulf of Maine is now one of the epicenters of global ocean climate change, that it is warming faster than 97% of the rest of the global ocean. And I felt, a sense of urgency and responsibility now to do that story and to try to bring visual context to what that meant. In my experience, a lot of folks may, that have busy lives may not fully appreciate what climate change is, or they don't understand it, or they think it's happening far away. But this is a body of water, the Gulf of Maine, that stretches from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, up through Nova Scotia, Canada, and in no small way fostered the colonization of America. The Basques and the Portuguese came over in the 14th, 15th century for codfish and so forth. And it's a place where millions of visitors come every year for vacation. So if I could give visual context to what climate change meant, I hope that maybe it would help folks have a better appreciation of what's happening and what the solutions are. So that was my sort of inspiration for doing this story now, these projects now. And to answer your other question, it was hard. There were many challenges because things are changing so fast. I can give you an example. In the years past, when I used to dive regularly in the Gulf of Maine, I had places that I knew to be very rich with subjects. Eastport, Maine was a place that I used to go back in the day after Thanksgiving every year. I would do a 3 or 4 or 5 day trip after the day after Thanksgiving and dive up there. And my friends and I would walk in off the beach. And I often described it as like walking into an aquarium or a jewelry store. There was so much color and invertebrate life. There were basket stars and telia anemones and metridium anemones and all these wonderful animals. And within a small area, I could photograph all these exotic looking creatures and fish too. I said when I started this project, I'm going to go back to Eastport. I will, spend many days up there because it's so rich with life. And yet I did two trips, several day trips during these projects, and I describe it as a ghost town. It was almost devoid of life. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but there was just mostly mud. There were a few anemones here and there, but nothing like I remembered just a couple of decades ago. So it became a challenge to find the subjects that I needed to tell the story.
At one point in the new series, you describe your 4-year search to find a group of sea stars feeding on mussels. What can you tell me about that search and just looking for a creature that people may assume, oh, sea stars, they've got to be all over the place on the ocean floor. We see them in aquariums. They've got to be easy to find.
Yes, this is a very important part of the story, really, and goes in line with what I was just talking about. So, again, for context, what I'm trying to do with these projects is multiple things. But for example, with the magazine story, I want to show the animals that still remain in the Gulf of Maine. I want to show the beauty of these animals. I want to show their fragility, their exquisiteness, because a big part of what I have learned is that, people protect what they love. So if we can help people love these animals, maybe we'll want to protect the Gulf of Maine. So that, sort of B-roll is part of it. I also need to show the visual aspects of what climate change means, baby birds choking on invasive species that their parents are bringing them because the native foraging fish are no longer around. So that was part of it. And sea stars, or something, as you said, that most people know exactly what they are. They're beautiful. They have rich colors. And I used to often see them routinely, as I did many invertebrates when I would go on dives in this region. But for 4 years, or the better part of 4 years, I was really coming up short. I would find them occasionally in, deep and dark places where there were extreme currents in the Piscataqua River, for example, where I only had a 20 or 30 minute window, and there might be, tankers going over my head because that's when they bring in the ships. And the conditions weren't that good to photograph these there. But in most of the places I normally found them, they weren't present. But on that expedition to Cache's Ledge, 90 miles offshore, 80 miles offshore, we found this one giant rock covered in blue mussels, and this abundance of sea stars feeding on those mussels. So yeah, it was one of the only places where I had an opportunity to work that subject.
You had mentioned the birds. I believe they were a species of tern that I saw in your National Geographic story, where there was a parent bird trying to feed its young a fish that was too big for its mouth. And it's a heartbreaking image. And I think it shows a lot of things. It shows, that the native species are still looking for ways to find their food for their young. But what is physically available and immediately available or easy for the birds to catch is not what they're used to eating. And there's a lot of emotion in that photograph. Is that something that when you're in your process, are you thinking of the human emotion that can be reflected in animal interactions when you are in the ocean or on a shore somewhere and you're actually taking the photographs?
Yes, I'm certainly aware of the emotional impact of being able to produce a photo or a video, which, and we got a great sequence in Sea Change, the documentary series, of that exact behavior. But for me, it begins with trying to identify during my research process, which might be, a year or two. It's about trying to identify visual elements that help people understand what climate change means. So the emotional impact of a scene or sequence or a photograph certainly is part of that equation, but the foundation is about how do I show climate change occurring right now in the Gulf of Maine? And one of the most visual elements that I found was terns and puffins, who historically feed their chicks slender-bodied silverfish like sand lance or whiting or herring, which they can easily swallow. And now, as the seawater temperatures are rising, those native species are not around very much. And a more, I don't want to call it an invasive species, but a species that used to be not very popular in the Gulf of Maine, but is moving up from southern waters now, like butterfish, which is silver in color, but is a wide-bodied fish. The parents see a silverfish, they grab it, they bring it back to their chick, but their chick can't swallow it, so they either choke or spit it out. And that means that the mortality rate, the scientific data shows that the mortality rate of those chicks is increasing as sea temperatures rise. So that, to me, we've got the scientific data from a researcher at UNH who's been working on this for over a decade. We can back it up with personal observations, and we have the video and the still photos. So I think that's a compelling argument for how climate change is impacting the Gulf of Maine right now.
I'm thinking of puffins in particular. There's Project Puffin and researchers who, for decades, have been working to reestablish puffin colonies in the islands right off the coast of Maine. And they may be at risk now because of the changing ocean and the changing food supply.
Yeah, 100%. I worked with Project Puffin. I worked with Don Lyons, the lead researcher there, and his team. I camped out on one of those islands a couple of years ago to photograph that very thing, the puffins bringing back butterfish, and I was able to photograph that. But you're right. As far as I know, and I think I'm correct about this, it was the first time ever that a bird species was relocated to another place and successfully, took hold there. Puffins used to live in the Gulf of Maine. They were, sort of wiped out, or for various reasons, they were no longer here. They brought them back. They've done very well. We can see them now in a number of locations. But now climate change is having this, serious impact and direct threat on, their survivability.
As a photographer who has captured change and climate change, how do you feel yourself about changing technologies, and in particular in the era of the internet and algorithms and artificial intelligence, how do you change your approach to meet a changing audience?
Well, if you're talking about, you know, how things can be manipulated or faked, let's say, and, you know, AI can create images that are not authentic, obviously I'm greatly concerned about this. You know, I attended at National Geographic, we had a little seminar a couple of years ago about AI and what it meant. And the instructors in this seminar came in and showed us a site that you could go into. And you know, I could type, I want to see a humpback whale photo in the style of Brian Skerry. And within seconds, one comes up and it looks very much like the kind of work that I do. And people can get that photo and, you know, there's no copyright protection currently for that kind of thing. So I guess, you know, it is a great concern for any artist, any you know, creator of original content made by humans. And what does it mean long term? You know, I would hope that humans will decide that when it comes to certain forms of art or certainly journalism, that we want authenticity. We want something that was created by humans. But, you know, the jury is out on that. I don't know what the long-term implications are, but certainly greatly concerned.
I'm sure that you believe the power of an image to be a driver of action and in reaching people and not only telling a story, but also prompting them to take the next steps or do what they feel like they should to solve a problem or do their small part in solving a larger problem.
I do, you know, unequivocally and absolutely. I've said often that, you know, I believe that human beings remember powerful still frames for the rest of our lives. I remember reading years ago that even when we watch a movie, the way our brain works, I think, is that it files it away as still frame. So when we think about a scene in a movie, we're not really seeing the video play in our mind where as much as we are a still photo. You know, we're sort of imagining a scene. And I would say that since the advent of still photography, humans have marked important events by those still frames. You know, we remember Matthew Brady's Civil War photos. We remember Tiananmen Square, the Kennedy assassination, man landing on the moon, whatever it is, as that iconic photo. And I think it is a very powerful tool to get people to be aware of things, maybe make better decisions. But if, you know, it's a slippery slope when that begins to get manipulated and we can't trust what we see. So there have to be authentic brands. There have to be entities out there, media organizations that, you know, remain above that fray and publish only what is authentic.
So, Brian, as Sea Change, the Gulf of Maine is brought into the world and people are going to have the chance to view it, what are you hoping for as far as an audience reception? Are you hoping for folks to get involved? And then looking down the line, have you already started looking at your next project and any more photography projects that might come out of the Gulf of Maine or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, Lucas. And I think, you know, my hope is that audiences for Sea Change, this documentary series on PBS, will come away being entertained, being enlightened, and maybe inspired in ways that they wouldn't have been prior to watching it. That's an aspirational goal, a pretty lofty goal. But, you know, this is a series that we created with multiple facets. In one regard, it is a classic blue chip natural history documentary where we're showing animals and wildlife and behavior. In another way, it's sort of social documentary or, you know, people stories. We've got coastal communities that are being innovative, that are, you know, pivoting to mitigate economic damage. So there's the economic side of this. We've got indigenous voices, Native Americans who have a, you know, 10 or 12,000 year baseline and their relationship with nature and how that changed when we became colonized and saw things as a commodity. So I think there's a lot of grist for the mill. I do hope that, viewers will become inspired to want to know more about the Gulf of Maine, that they will become involved in efforts to protect it. You know, as of right now, there is no take marine reserve within the entire Gulf of Maine. And yet we know that climate stability is achieved through marine conservation. So I think those kinds of things are important. But at the end of the day, this is not about preaching or anything else. It's wonderful, rich stories of people and animals living in or near the Gulf of Maine and all of those relationships and what they mean.
And where will your next adventure be?
I am currently in development on a couple of different projects, just in the very early stages. So nothing to report on that. But I will say to your question about are there other stories in the Gulf of Maine? Yes, absolutely. I remain completely interested and engaged. There is an endless source of storytelling to be done in this region, if particularly for me in the ocean. And I think we and I just scratched the surface with both the Nat Geo cover story in June and this PBS series. There's so much more that needs to be told.
Well, Brian Scarry, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Lucas. Thank you.
Brian Scarry's photography in the Gulf of Maine is featured in the June 2024 issue of National Geographic Magazine and a three-part PBS Nova series, Sea Change, The Gulf of Maine. I'm Lucas Willard. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. Laura Holmesy is an educator, illustrator, and creator of Petite Paper Stories, where customers can commission a cut paper style portrait. Inspired by late artist and illustrator Eric Carle, Holmesy is completing her first book for children, Action ABCs. She spoke with Jody Cowan about her work and artistic process.
I work in hand-cut paper art, so spend the majority of my time studying people's faces and creating artworks for others. So I consider myself an illustrator because I'm replicating faces and personalities in my craft.
Are there any particular materials or techniques that you use to develop the colors and textures present in your art?
Yep, I use acrylic paints and watercolor paints. I like to mix watercolors and acrylics together to create kind of soft tones. And then I use different texture tools. So when I teach students, I show them that even forks can create different textures. So if you think about grass and you're working in 2D, how can you create that same texture? So you can use forks. Bubble wrap is great for clouds and certain textures. You can use everyday items to create textures. So I start with a blank piece of paper. I hand paint, and then I use my different texture tools. And then I cut them out into usable pieces of paper. And then I see where they fit. What I end up doing for each piece I create, each commission, is I paint for each piece that I'm doing. I just finished one. A girl's moving into her first apartment in the Bronx. And so I was given the neighborhood in Little Italy that I have to refer to. So I look at the different colors and textures and temperatures that I want to, you know, convey in the piece. And I paint to order, essentially.
Working with such small pieces of paper and an influx of ideas, have you created a system of organization that helps you with your workflow?
That's a work in progress, but I use rolling carts for my paints. I have filing cabinets to keep my painted papers, but I also keep my painted papers below these carts. And then I have these shelves over here that are trying to aid in organization, but it's something I grew up not knowing how to stay organized. So I'm still learning.
When starting a new portrait, do you have a fully decided visual layout that you work towards, or is it kind of like putting a puzzle together with arranging and rearranging of all the pieces?
I'd say it's a puzzle. Some people want me to recreate an existing photograph that they have, and that's a little easier for me to think about. But some people want me to work with maybe three or four different photos and kind of bring aspects of each into one cohesive piece. So that would be more of a puzzle. I like to study the landscape first. So I just did a piece for a couple who got married in Spain. So I studied that town in Spain first before I started to sketch. It just starts with sketches. And then sometimes I throw the sketches out the window and I just get to cutting. And what's great about this is it's malleable. So I'm able to, like you said, move pieces around, see what fits. It takes me many hours to study faces. It's my favorite part, but it's also the biggest challenge of what I do.
It seems you really get to work with a wide variety of people who bring all types of ideas to you. Is there any standout commissions that you've worked on?
Well, in a couple weeks, I'm going to do a piece for, it's a portrait of a woman and her 40-year-old donkey named Bobby. You can't make it up. She wants her house in the background, her and her pet donkey of 40 years in front. So that stands out. I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to look forward to that. I remember a funny one I did was a woman was retiring from her position as a school secretary. And one thing that this lady used to do, she loved to scare her coworkers. So she would get big cardboard cutouts of bears. She would dress up. And so the woman who approached me wanted to kind of capture her wit in a piece. One other one was a daughter wanted to memorialize her father who passed away. So she wanted her father and her mother illustrated within their kitchen, making his famous chili recipe. So she shared the recipe with me and I got to illustrate, you know, all the paper foods, which was really fun. I sent one piece to Iran, which was really cool. And I had to learn all about kind of the religion and how to send things through the mail. I sent a piece to Germany and I've done pretty much every province in Quebec. And I have a lot of clients in Rochester that I just adore. When I'm not working on other people's ideas, it's a little challenging for me to create, if I can say so. I really rely on people to fuel my creativity.
And in the spirit of that challenge, you have a book for children in the works titled Action ABCs with Cat and Friends. Is this your first book project?
It is. So a dream of mine has always been to illustrate a children's book, and I didn't know how to get in there in that world. Social media is great, but it could be overwhelming. So I said, I'm just going to do it myself, create one. And it's very much a self-published endeavor. So I'm chugging along. I decided to work with the ABCs because it's simplistic in my mind. And I also thought, how can I show action with each character? So I have a kid and their cat friend on each page kind of acting out the ABCs. So, you know, for example, B for build, I have the cat and this girl that I created, and they are acting out build together.
Is your approach to creating the illustrations for this book different than how you might usually work?
It is, in that I'm creating every face and every entity just from my own creating. So I'm not really referring to anybody's face per se, and I'm just creating the action. I'm choosing the action for each page. So it's very much all coming from me, really. I get inspiration from different kids in my life, so I'm building that into the book too.
And I'm sure the illustration side felt familiar, but how was the process of actually writing the book?
Right. That's a good question. I'm really good at writing like jingles. That's something that I started as a kid and kind of have created. So the rhyming kind of comes easy to me. I'm keeping it very simplistic. I'm focusing maybe more on the illustrations, but I'm having fun with rhyming and just keeping it real simple as my first book and really approachable. I'm showing kids of all colors, all ages, all abilities in this book, and I just want to include everybody.
Artist and illustrator Laura Holmesy speaking with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1767. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.